We're beginning a study on the book of Hebrews. Of course, it's one of the major New Testament books, but many Christians, while they know some of the great verses in the book, for instance, let's come boldly before the throne of grace, verses like that, they don't tend to know the flow of the arguments. This tremendous presentation of Christ that is in some ways unique in the New Testament. And so our goal here is to get the flow of where he's going over these 13 chapters. And indeed, it is it's a book like Romans that is just so full of the revelation of Christ. But before beginning, I need to acknowledge some of the resources I've used in the study. There are, of course, many fine commentaries available on the book, but my own primary sources are F.F. Bruce in his Hebrews commentary in the New International Commentary Series on the New Testament, and William Lane in the Word Biblical Commentary Series, from whom I've also taken the seven main divisions of the book that I use. I've also used various other minor works in addition, of course, to my own personal study over the years. And I'll sometimes use the commentary material without giving the page number and other details, simply because to do so repeatedly when teaching, as opposed to writing, breaks up the flow of what is already a very complex argument in Hebrews. However, these references are not hard to track down by looking up the specific verse I'm using in the commentaries I've just mentioned. One important point to make that I've already hinted at is that Hebrews, like Romans, is a very complex book, and there's no way to avoid the hard work involved in studying it. However, it's rich and complex simply because of the crucial material it's seeking to present. And therefore, although it might sound obvious, it's really important that you read the chapters for yourself before listening to the lecture. I'll do my best to make it clear, but you still won't get the most out of the book unless you become somewhat familiar with the content of each chapter ahead of listening to the lecture itself. Many people have told me over the years that they enjoy listening to my teaching when they're traveling in the car, and that's great. You can always go back and make notes afterwards. But unless you've previously read the chapter I'm teaching, it will be difficult for you to follow, particularly in Hebrews. So if you do your bit and I do my bit, it should be well worth the effort by the time we finally reach chapter 13. So just a bit of background before we begin. Let's see here. I've got a number of things to say, and they are important. First, the writer of Hebrews does not identify himself, but he was obviously well known to the Jewish believers who received the epistle. But there was no agreement in the early church as to who wrote it. But from about 400 AD to about 1600 AD, the book was commonly called the Epistle of Paul to the Hebrews. Now, it would be nice if it was as simple as that, but since the Reformation, for several reasons, many have thought that Paul could not have written it. And there are several reasons why. First is that Paul, you remember, always identifies himself at the beginning of his epistles, in writing his greeting to the church or to an individual. He says, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ," or something like that. And second, in Hebrews 2:3, the author says, "This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us," confirmed to us by those who heard him. And the little phrase, confirmed to us, notice the author includes himself in that word us, confirmed to us by those who heard him, seems to indicate that the author had not been one of the apostles who had been with Jesus during his earthly ministry and heard him directly, nor somebody like Paul, who had heard the Lord for himself on the road to Damascus, and also heard from the Lord by receiving special revelation, as he claims in Galatians, directly from Jesus, that empowered him to write his epistles. So this would seem to rule out the author being one of the 12 apostles or the apostle Paul. Another suggestion was made by the church father Tertullian in around 200 AD. He quotes from a letter that he describes as, quote, an epistle to the Hebrews under the name Barnabas. However, although Barnabas does meet some of the requirements for being the author of the book, you remember he was a Jew of the priestly tribe of Levi, we discover that early in the book of Acts, and was well tutored by the apostle Paul himself, both in Antioch and when he traveled with Paul on his first missionary journey. But while Barnabas could have written it, there's no evidence that he actually did so. The other leading candidate is Apollos. His name was first put forward by Martin Luther and is still popular with many interpreters today. And Luke tells us that Apollos was, quote, an eloquent man who was mighty in the scriptures. That's Acts 18:24. We also know that Apollos was associated with Paul in the early years of the church in Corinth. We read that in 1 Corinthians 1, 1 Corinthians 3, twice. And Apollos was a Jewish believer with great intellectual and preaching gifts. However, there's no way of knowing for sure, unfortunately, if he was the author or not. What we do know is that the author was a master of the Greek language and very familiar with the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which he quotes throughout the epistle. And before moving on, we should note that many of the biblical books don't state who their author was. And this is particularly true in the Old Testament. However, authorship must not be confused with authority. Books were accepted into the canon of Scripture because they were recognized shortly after they began to be circulated as having divine inspiration and authority, or as Peter says, of having been God-breathed. The rule seems to have been that the authorship of a book had to be by an apostle or by somebody who would have been known and recognized by the apostolic community. The Gospel of Mark would be an example. Mark was not an apostle, but he was well known by the apostolic community and spent time working with Paul and Barnabas, and later on in life, a considerable amount of time working with Peter. And so when he wrote his gospel, the Gospel of Mark, he was known and recognized by the apostolic community. Then as far as the dates is concerned, the dates of when it was written, Hebrews was probably written before the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. And there are two reasons for this. First, if it had been written after the destruction of the temple, the author would have mentioned this catastrophe as the sacrificial system and priesthood that he speaks so much about for chapters would have come to a dramatic and devastating ending. And he surely would have mentioned it. And second, the author always uses the Greek present tense when speaking of the temple and the activities of the priests. all of which leads us to assume that the temple was still standing and sacrifices still being offered at the time it was written. Therefore, we're probably on solid ground in assuming it was written before 70 AD. And some of these facts in the introduction might seem rather unnecessary, but they are important when we come to certain passages if we're going to interpret them correctly. So they might seem a bit obscure, but they really are necessary as we get into the text of the epistle. The letter itself is primarily addressed to Jewish converts, hence it's called the Letter to the Hebrews. It seems that these Jewish believers were now being tempted to go back to Judaism, or at least to accept a Judaized version of the gospel. And that becomes very important in several chapters, that these were Jewish believers, but there were teachers circulating who were either, we're not sure, tempting them to go back to Judaism, or, as I say, to accept a very, very Jewish legalistic version of the gospel. Now, they were probably not living in Israel, as the reader's knowledge of the various Jewish ceremonial rites seems to have come from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, rather from the Hebrew used in the temple in Jerusalem. An interesting positive insight about these believers, because there's lots of negative things or warnings given to them, is found in Hebrews 6:10, which says, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you've shown him as you've helped his people and continue to help them. And this probably means that they gave money to help poor congregations. And these could have been the Jewish believers in Judea, who we know became very poor later on in the first century. Remember, we read both in Acts 11, Romans 15, and 2 Corinthians 8 of a collection being made for the churches in Judea from the churches in Greece and Asia Minor. So again, this would indicate that although they were Hebrews, they probably didn't live in Judea itself. And there's another interesting statement in chapter 13, verse 24, that says, those from Italy greet you. And this sounds like there were a group of Italian believers in the congregation who were now living away from Italy and using the final greeting at the end of the epistle to send their greetings back home to their friends. And if so, Italy, and probably Rome, could have been the destination of the letter. And in fact, the first historical reference to Hebrews appears in Rome itself. It's cited in an ancient text that was not included in the New Testament, called the Book of First Clement, which might again lend weight to the fact that it was written originally to believers in Rome. We can't be sure, but the evidence kind of stacks up in that direction. Now, another insight as to these believers themselves is that we read in 10:25 that these Hebrew Christians were not meeting together frequently enough. You remember that verse, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Now, we tend to think that this means that they were not meeting together enough as a church, but the writer could mean that they're not meeting often enough as a mixed group containing both Jewish and Gentile Christians, but rather meeting separately in Jewish house groups. And if so, this would give us another hint that they did not live in Israel, because, of course, The territory at that time was populated very largely by Jews, but rather in a more cosmopolitan city like Rome. And again, the Hebrews are told as a group in the epistle, this is in 13:24, to greet all your leaders and all the saints. In other words, to greet not only the leaders and fellow believers in their own fellowship, but also all the saints. And this could again indicate that as believing Jews, they had broken away from the churches that were mixed Gentile and Jewish congregations. Now, we can't be sure of this, but it gives us a further hint that they lived outside of Palestine and also explains some of the important content of the letter. And in fact, it would explain a lot of the content of the letter and the direction the author is going and the warnings that he's giving in the book. Now, before moving on, I should mention some of the important distinctives of the book as they highlight some of the unique richness and depth of the epistle. And how many have I got here? I think I've got about three, I'm not sure. Anyway, first, its use of the Old Testament. According to William Lane, there are about 31 quotations of the Old Testament, four implicit quotations of the Old Testament, a minimum of 37 allusions to the Old Testament, another 19 instances where Old Testament material is summarized, and 13 more where a biblical name or topic is cited without reference to a specific Old Testament context. Now, if I've got it right, that adds up to 119 uses of the Old Testament, not counting all the exegesis that the author does himself to explain the passages he's quoting. In other words, it's a book that is crammed full of the Old Testament. Second, William Lane points out that no other New Testament writer uses Psalm 110, Psalm 40, or Jeremiah 31, and we'll come to all these passages, to provide a unique perspective on the work of Christ. And it's a perspective that's different to Paul's or any other New Testament writer. And by the way, the author quotes or alludes to Psalm 110, which is a very short psalm, no less than 14 times in the epistle. So 119 uses of the Old Testament, not counting all the exegesis that the author himself does to explain the passages he's quoting, and then even Psalm, that little Psalm 110, quoted 14 times. Incredible. Third, there are a number of distinctive words that are used in Hebrews that give an indication of the flow of where this argument is going. The word perfect or perfected, referring to the new covenant and the work of Christ, is used 13 times. The word better, sometimes translated superior, indicating that the new covenant is better or superior to the old, is used 15 times. And the phrase, let us, as an exhortation, is used 13 times in these 13 chapters. I'll give some examples so you can kind of get a feel of these exhortations, these let us exhortations. Chapter 4, verse 11, let us therefore strive to enter God's rest. 4:14, let us hold fast to our confession. 4:16, let us draw near to the throne of grace. 6:1, let us press on to perfection. 10:23, let us hold fast to the confession of our faith. Then 10:24, let us consider how to stir one another up to love and good works. And then 12:1, let us lay aside every weight and run the race that's set before us. Then 13:15, let us offer up a sacrifice of praise. And that's quite a list for starters, so I won't mention the others now, but we'll come to them as we progress chapter by chapter through the book. As far as the reason for writing the epistle is concerned, as I've said, Hebrews was written to strengthen and encourage a discouraged church of Jewish converts who are either thinking of going back to Judaism or embracing a Judaized gospel. And the author wants to exhort them to stay faithful and to have courage in the face of persecution, which was probably coming from the unbelieving Jewish community. And you can imagine this group of Hebrew believers reflecting on the fact that all the splendor of the temple, the ceremonies, the feasts, the sacrifices, everything that was the glory of Israel, they had now exchanged all this for meeting in an ordinary house. And as a result, all the majesty and ceremony of the worship that they had known, that was so familiar to them, had vanished. And they believed in Jesus as the Messiah, but now everything was, in one sense, spiritual and invisible. And they're simply homesick for the external glories that they once knew in temple worship. So what the author tries to show them and to press it home is that what they have now, even though it lacks external glory, physical glory, is in fact the core and the essence of what the glories of the temple were always pointing towards. So as they're considering returning to an old covenant style of worship, he reminds them that these things were just shadows of the reality of the revelation of God in Christ, and that in Jesus they have something that's superior to every old covenant provision of law, priesthood, temple, and sacrifice. However, for those of us living today, everything has always been in the Spirit and not in external structures. And it's easy for us to think that they're foolish in longing for the old visible ceremonies. But that's because we've never known or experienced the visual splendor and external glory that they knew. And it's hard for us to stand in their shoes. But we should try. We should try. Because then it becomes easier to have a greater sympathy for these Jewish believers and the tension that they felt themselves to be in. Perhaps it would not be unlike somebody today leaving a high liturgical church and joining a simple group of believers meeting in a house church. And while since joining the house church, they know that they've now found true life, not that there's no true life in a high liturgical church, they still might long for the splendors of the liturgy and the icons they had known previously in that high liturgical church. And perhaps this rough and ready illustration of what is going on in the lives of the is an illustration of what was going on in the lives of the Hebrew believers to whom the book is addressed. And all this brings us to the question of why do we, those of us who are not Jews, need a book like Hebrews. We can understand why the Hebrew Christians needed it, especially those who lived in the first century and had participated in temple worship. But why do those of us who are Gentile believers need a book like this? Now, there are many examples that could be given, but let me give just one. It's a book that helps us to grasp the majesty of the gospel, particularly in areas of worship that we can tend to regard as commonplace. For instance, talking to God informally is normal for us, but familiarity, as we know, has the danger of breeding complacency and losing the crucial dimension of majesty. And we need to remember that the ordinary Israelite, the Levites, and the priest could not even enter the presence of God. We tend to forget that only one man on planet Earth, the high priest, and on only one day of the year, and for just a very short amount of time, could even go into the presence of God. But now, as we well know, those of us in Christ can go into our Father's presence at any time, as often as we want. But as I said, this very familiarity has the danger of becoming commonplace. And so by pointing out the strict regulations surrounding the Old Testament priests, Levites, offerings, and sacrifices, the author of the Hebrews leads us into a deeper appreciation of the work of Jesus on our behalf. And of course, there are other reasons why we need the book, but this illustration is just one dimension of its importance and relevance for us today. Now, as the book of Hebrews is more complex than most of the New Testament books, not all, but it's more complex than many, I'm going to use a simple map or outline by William Lane that will help us navigate through the epistle. And it goes something like this. He has 7 points. And again, the author wants to point out the superiority of Jesus to every Old Testament covenant, person, and institution. And remember that the Greek word for better or superior is used 15 times in the book. And so he demonstrates this by the things. There's 6, or actually 7, with a conclusion that William Lane picks out to demonstrate this dimension of what we have in Jesus being superior. Number one on the outline, Jesus is superior to the prophets, and he provides a superior revelation than they did, as he is the exact representation of the very being of God. And we're going to find that in the first 3 verses of chapter 1. Then 2, Jesus is superior. We're going to find that in the first 3 verses of chapter 1. Then 2, Jesus is superior to the angels. And we'll find that in chapter 1, verse 4, through to chapter 2, verse 18. Then 3, Jesus is superior to Moses and Joshua, as they were never able to lead God's people into the true rest of God. We find that in chapter 3, verse 1, through to chapter 4, verse 13. Then point 4, the priesthood of Jesus, really rephrase that. The priesthood of Jesus that is from Melchizedek is superior to that of the Levitical priesthood from Aaron. And that's chapter 4, 14 through chapter 7, 28. And by the way, what the author means is that the priesthood of Melchizedek is superior to that of Levi, simply because Genesis tells us that Melchizedek was superior to Abraham. And it was, and of course, it was from Abraham that Levi was descended. And so he is, inferior to Melchizedek, because he's descended from Abraham. And in addition, Melchizedek, you remember, was both a king and a priest, whereas priests from Levi could never be kings. And then finally, he says, and this comes up in chapter 7, that Melchizedek was a person, and I'm quoting here from chapter 7, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, which all sounds very odd, but I'll explain more when we get to chapter 7. But he's basically saying that Melchizedek foreshadowed the priesthood of Jesus in a way that the priesthood of Levi never could, because it took partook of both humanity and deity in a way that the Levitical priesthood never could. Continuing on William Lane's outline that we're using, point 5 is that Jesus gives us a superior covenant, sanctuary, and sacrifice. That's chapter 8, verse 1, all the way through chapter 10, verse 31. And he'll point out that a superior or a new covenant was promised in Jeremiah 31 when he prophesied that the law would be written on our hearts and that we would be empowered by the Spirit to keep it. And in addition, in addition to the superior covenant, he points out that the superior sanctuary is in heaven, that which they were longing for, that which they saw in Jerusalem. He says the real one, the superior one, is in heaven, and that the tabernacle and temple were only ever shadows of this heavenly reality. Then he points out, still under point 5 of his outline, that not only do we have a superior covenant and sanctuary, but we also have a superior sacrifice that provides, in the words of F.F. Bruce, a decisive moral cleansing and permanent access into the presence of God. And the phrase being made perfect that's used several times of Christ now also refers to us as those who are in Christ and have now been delivered from guilt and shame. Then point 6 on the outline is that Jesus gives us a way of faith that is superior to the Mosaic law. And that runs from chapter 10, verse 32, all the way to chapter 12, verse 29. And in chapter 10, the words that Paul uses in Romans and Galatians, you remember he quotes from the Old Testament, the book of Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. And in chapter 10, he uses that phrase. And then in chapter 11, he illustrates it by that incredible list of many of the Old Testament saints, the kind of heroes of faith, who lived lives of costly faith and obedience, demonstrating what it means to be justified by faith. And finally, from 13:1 to 13:25, the whole of chapter 13, the book is concluded by exhortations, prayer, and finishes with a postscript. And although I'll mention these 6 divisions and the conclusion in chapter 13 as we go through the epistle bit by bit, It might help you to navigate the text and not get lost in the details if you jot down the outline so you can refer to it as we're going through. Of course, I'll mention it, but it will help you to not get lost in all the details as we go through. And there's one final thing I should mention before we begin to look at the text. The high priest is mentioned many times in Hebrews, and this is a problem to many of us living in the 21st century. It's simply hard for us to relate to the concept of a high priest, as we've never lived in a society where there's anyone in leadership or in government approaching the importance that the high priest had in Israel. He was indispensable to the nation and was of much more importance than any king, prime minister, or president in the modern nation state. Without him, they had no access to God, and without him, the nation simply couldn't function. They could do without a king, but not without a high priest. So while it's not easy, we need to keep in mind, when the book repeatedly goes back to speaking of the high priest, that for the readers, he was an indispensable figure in the history and life of their nation. And as I said, there's no one of equal importance in any nation on the planet today. It was simply a unique role. They were the people of God, and he was the unique mediator between them and Yahweh. And Israel simply couldn't be Israel without a high priest. And by way of contrast, we never speak about a high priest in our society. It's not exactly a term that we read every day in the newspapers and see on the TV news. So I'll sometimes call him by another title, something like the chief mediator, to try and make his role relevant and meaningful to those of us living in secular societies in the West. And even in places like India, where they have thousands of priests, their role is not such that the nation can't exist without them. And so again, it's hard for us to find anyone anywhere today that would equal the importance of this person in the history of biblical Israel. So yes, the writer will go back to him again and again, but we have to realize the reason why. Well, sorry about all that. Even the introduction was a lot to cover, but having now laid the foundations, we'll get into the text of chapter 1. Revelation than they did, as he is the exact representation of the very being of God. And we're going to find that in the first three verses of chapter 1. Then 2, Jesus is superior to the angels. And we'll find that representation of the very being of God. And we're going to find that in the first three verses of chapter 1. Then 2, Jesus is superior to the angels. And we'll find that in chapter 1, verse 4, through to chapter 2, verse